Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This is a grave moment in our history. We have just reached a point in America when COVID-19 exacts a toll like a daily 9/11, nearly 3,000 deaths a day. We live now in a strange and liminal state. On the one hand, a vaccine is around the corner. It really is coming. But we're nowhere near containing this pandemic, nowhere near the end of the tragedy. None of us wants to hear it much, but this will be the worst of winters. Atul Gawande is a surgeon and a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he was just appointed to President-elect Biden's COVID-19 task force. We talked last week about the shape of the months to come. When this began, I read the book about 1918 by John Barry, a terrific book, a history of the horrendous flu that killed millions worldwide and many hundreds of thousands in the United States. And there was all kinds of evidence there about the number of parades and public gatherings that people had, heedless of all kinds of public warnings. And I thought to myself, well, it's not possible that we would repeat these mistakes again, because after all, we learn from history, even if the President of the United States does not. And yet, how is it possible that we made these mistakes on such a mass scale? Do you lay it all at the feet of the President of the United States?
I think there's a big part of this that I lay at the feet of the president. Imagine Pearl Harbor happened, and there was an attack that hit, one part of the country. And then we spent 7 or 8 months deciding whether we were or not going to fight back. The problems to solve here are really clear. The hospitals learned how to bring people to work and have them succeed. And it was a formula that included masks, included some basic hygiene, some basic distancing, and testing at least everybody who had a symptom and making it possible for them to stay home from work. That's been the formula, is the formula still, for making it possible for people to have resumed a normal life. We did not have a commitment from the very top to make this happen on a national basis. And we are continuing to litigate that issue to this very day.
You are now on President-elect Biden's advisory board on COVID-19. And I wonder what kind of cooperation you're getting from the Trump administration's own advisory board.
Well, remember, up until just a few days ago, there was no contact allowed at all between any administration officials and the Biden-Harris transition team.
Wait, I'm sorry to interrupt, Atul, but just to be clear here, in a public health emergency, the president's own theories, ill-founded and fantastical theories about the election, for 3 weeks and more held up any communication whatsoever between President Trump's advisory board and President-elect Biden's. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And I want to, let's put a pin in what that means in concrete fact. Here we had a vaccine trial that came out 3 weeks ago, followed it just a few days later by another vaccine trial. We did not have access to the information they were getting about what's the status of those trials. We did not have access to information about supplies. So at the beginning of the year with Operation Warp Speed, the target was 300 million vaccines produced by the end of the year. Instead, what we're seeing is reportedly 30 million or so by the end of this month. Why? What were the bottlenecks that meant that this couldn't be done? Is it a shortage of raw ingredients? Are they having stockpile problems? Is it a problem with the actual production process? These are brand new kinds of vaccines. And what are they tackling? Now, all of this will be learned in the days to come. But, at the present time, it's just starting to learn this basic information.
Now, the Biden administration or administration-to-be's COVID-19 task force has got a 7-point plan to stop the pandemic. What are the crucial elements of that plan?
Well, I think it is still the same story that we've known since April. It's masks and mandating masks, It's testing and being able to make sure there's widespread availability of testing. It's supplies for the places that are going to need proper gloves, masks, et cetera. You know, I'm firmly in agreement with where the president-elect has been going on heeding the advice from public health people that schools can be opened. But in order for kids to be back in schools, especially elementary and middle schools, there's still a lot of work to do to ensure they have the supplies that they need to maintain distancing, to have the right ventilation. And those are components that are going to be part of this picture as well.
Now, one of the signal disasters in the Trump administration was communication, both what the president said about the pandemic and how he said it, the attitude he took toward it. We're well over, what, a quarter of a million dead? A quarter of a million now dead. And the president of the United States doesn't even talk about it on a daily basis. Not a word.
No, he's been AWOL. It's interesting, however. In some ways, that is preferable to coming in and constantly undermining the public health messaging. And so the irony is Trump administration scientists and doctors get to speak with one voice about saying, wear your mask, avoid large spaces, please don't travel. So ironically, look, if I have to have President Trump on the airwaves contradicting everybody or being AWOL, I'd rather have him be AWOL.
Obviously, communications is crucial, but something, thankfully, that we can look forward to is a vaccine, but that presents enormous logistical challenges. What do you see as the rollout for the vaccine? Because clearly the lion's share of that is going to be on the Biden administration. What are the challenges and how do you view that rolling out?
Well, this is an undertaking on another scale from anything we've been doing in the last year so far. For example, deploying testing to all the Americans in the country. We have deployed north of 120 million coronavirus tests in the course of 8 months. This is going to be 330 million vaccinations twice and hoping to accomplish it in the course of 6 months or less. This is with vaccines that are a new kind of vaccine that hasn't been produced at this volume before, and that their clinical data is just undergoing review for approval by the FDA now. The task is muddied by the fact that we don't have a clear understanding of what the supply situation we have inherited from the Trump administration is. And we don't also know even what the prioritization is. So in the next week or so, the first approval from the FDA could come as early as that for a vaccine. And vaccinations would get started 24 to 48 hours after the approval. There's already vaccines flying out on airplane flights to different positions in the country. There hasn't been clear notification how much vaccine is there, which states will get how much. So I'm concerned that what will happen when the new administration starts is that they will inherit a lot of confusion in the public, because each state is now coming to its own conclusion about how they're going to prioritize things. And there's going to be such demand. People are going to clamor for this vaccine. And if they think that the system is rigged, we will have even more trouble building cohesiveness.
And I would think, Atul, after you get past nursing home and heavens, which are a couple million people, and people like my brother, people like you who are seeing patients all the time, nurses, emergency healthcare workers, all those people getting it because they're coming into contact with it every day, all the time, the next level is even harder. It's almost like some terrible philosophical, moral, ethical conundrum that philosophers are faced with all the time in academic papers. What are your discussions like when it comes to those levels?
There are 87 million essential workers who are at heightened risk of exposure to people because they are meat packers that are exposed to coworkers who could have COVID. It's grocery store workers. It's bus drivers who are exposed as people come on and off of public transportation. And there's a lot of unclarity. Who's in that category? Who's not in that category? And how do you make it simple for people to identify? You know, you'll be able to go to your local pharmacy and get a vaccine, but what they need to know is, how do they identify who's the bus driver and who's not?
Will the government be able to guarantee us that wealthy people, connected people won't be able to, you know a guy, know somebody?
I think this is one of the critical tests and an opportunity. The chance to prove that the system is not rigged should not be underestimated. It's hard because the bus drivers never came before the bankers before, in priority for anything. I can imagine a million ways people paying someone off, $2,500 to get your work ID tag. Again, this is all about rallying people together. It can't just be about the rules. It has to be about how we all understand and work together.
What you're talking about is community and common interest and fairness. And many people are very good about that on the level of rhetoric. But when it comes to the level of their health and their children's health or their parents' health, that's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, and it's going to be, I think, the mass debate and antagonism we've had over the last few months is nothing compared to the splits we will see over, I want my family to be vaccinated. You know, one person in the family might get vaccinated, another person might not, because they have an illness profile or they have a job that fits in that way. You'll have children who some families want to have vaccinated and others will not want to have vaccinated because pediatric clinical trials have only just gotten underway and we won't see those results for a while.
So I live in the autism community. I have a child with severe autism, and so I pay very close attention to the anti-vaxxer movement. And the statistics, the numbers of people who say they will not be vaccinated is enormous. And that has implications not only for themselves, but for our overall effort to have herd immunity, doesn't it?
It does. One of the questions is, it seems to be somewhere around 70% or so of people, if we can get them vaccinated, that would stop the transmission just through vaccination alone. And if once people start getting vaccinated, they start throwing the masks away and you can't get them to do anything else like distancing, et cetera, then you're really relying on vaccination as the sole prong of the strategy come 3-4 months from now. On one level, I think there are lots of things that are keeping that numbers of people who resist vaccination small.
Surveys indicate now? What are the numbers?
The numbers suggest that it's up as many as 40%, even up to 50%, who have said that they're not ready to take the vaccine if the FDA approves it. However, part of the reason it's good that healthcare workers would go first is just demonstrating that we ourselves are willing to get vaccinated. And, you know, like everything else, there's what you read in the news and what you see advertised in ads, et cetera. But then there's what you see in your own society, in your own neighborhood. And healthcare workers are everywhere, which means we're all going to know people who got vaccinated, and we're going to see that they did all right.
Well, what would it take to eradicate, or are we never going to eradicate it?
Well, you don't have to get every single human being vaccinated in order to eradicate. You need to get enough people vaccinated so that the disease stops spreading and dies out. And within a place like the United States, I'm hopeful that we can get it under control here. But to get eradication, you really have to get the whole world vaccinated, and that will take years. That will take years. Now, if we are well vaccinated, we will feel comfortable over time lifting our restrictions on travel to the United States. It'll become freer for us to travel to many places around the world. But it won't be long. It'll be, you know, a few months in, and we will begin to realize what a lot of public health people like me have been saying, which is, this can't just be about distribution of vaccine in the United States. This is also going to need to be about enabling global vaccination.
At what point do you think you'll feel comfortable, you, Atul Gawande, eating in crowded restaurants, flying on planes the way you used to fairly regularly, living the life that you lived a year ago?
I was in, I'm actually a trial participant. So part of the thing that's running through my brain is one of the moments I'm going to feel most comfortable is when I find out whether I got a placebo or I got the vaccine.
Well, come clean. What trial are you in? Can you say?
I'm in the Moderna trial, mm-hmm. the Moderna vaccine trial, and I want to see the evidence that that is lasting. So, you know, what is the story 3 months from now, and are the antibodies showing indications that it lasts? I suspect that we'll really feel comfortable that we're able to largely return to normal maybe in about 6 months' time. But I'm so desperate to go to a concert. Like music is the thing I miss sure. the absolute most. And, you know, it will be a reasonable calculation, but I do want some more information about, will I transmit it to any of my patients? You know, might I get an asymptomatic case and turn out to be spreading it to others? That information will come from the subsequent work in the trials, but that's still some time away.
If you get your wish and live music comes back sometime soon in 2021, what's the first concert you'd like to go to?
I think the last concert I was going to see was a Peter Bjorn and John concert, an indie band in a, you know, one of those small crowded clubs. And of course it got canceled, they got rescheduled, and maybe they will be coming back in the fall next year. I hope they will.
I hope so too. Thanks so much, Atul.
Thank you.
I talked to Atul Gawande last week. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1998, a practicing surgeon in Boston, and a member of Joe Biden's COVID-19 task force. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. There's a new series streaming now on Amazon that is unlike anything else you'll see right now. It's called Small Acts, and it's the work of the British director Steve McQueen. The New Yorker's Richard Brody was just blown away by Small Acts, and he spoke with Steve McQueen recently. Here's Richard.
Steve McQueen is the director of four feature films, Hunger, Shame, and Widows, and is best known as the director of the Oscar-winning 12 Years a Slave.
Do I upset the master and the mistress? Do you care less about my loss than their well-being?
Master Ford is a decent man.
He is a slaver.
Under the circumstances.
Under the circumstances, he's a slaver. But you truckle at his boot.
No.
You luxuriate in his favor.
I survive.
Steve McQueen's new project is called Small Axe. It's on the BBC in the UK and Amazon here, but it's not actually a TV series. Rather, it's a collection of five separate feature films, each of which deals with a different aspect of the lives of West Indian people in London from the late 1960s through the 1980s.
These are new men. new types of human beings. It is in them that are to be found all the traditional virtues of the English nation, not in decay, as they are in official society, but in full flower.
Rita.
Because these men have...
Had you had this in mind from the very start of your career as a feature filmmaker? At what point did this project crystallize for you?
2008, 2009, when I knew that I at some point I will have to sort of come to this point. But I wasn't ready yet because there was fear, basically, about, I'll be honest with you. You know, you need that distance and time and space to be brave to sort of delve into them because they're so close.
McQueen himself grew up in the West Indian community in London. And from the very beginning of the Small Axe series, which is to say from the first moments of the first film, Mangrove, it's obvious that Small Axe is a work of great personal urgency and of love. McQueen is now in his 50s, but he's been a film and video maker for more than 20 years. And it's as if he's been waiting his entire career to tell the stories in Small Axe. Some of the stories in the series are drawn from history. Some, he imagines, and others emerge from his personal experience. One of the films in the series, Education, is derived from McQueen's own experience as a student in London, and in particular, from the racial bias that he both experienced and observed there.
On Friday, we didn't do anything all day. Nothing. The teacher came into the classroom after assembly for about 10 seconds. We just sat all morning doing nothing.
Come on, it can't be that bad.
What about the other children? They make animal noises. It's so boring.
Well, you used to say law school was boring.
Yeah, but this isn't even a school. It's not a school if the teachers don't teach you anything.
What are you two chatting about?
I'll explain. Basically, there were these schools called the educationally subnormal schools, which were created in the late 60s, early 70s. And these were to sort of house people who they thought obviously couldn't cope with school. And a lot of those children were of West Indian descent, black descent. And what happened with black community at that time were the parents got involved, where they had these things called Saturday schools, where they kind of fought back to sort of, you know, to take their children out of these sort of dead-end sort of educational systems.
I am a mother of three boys growing them up in London. I was horrified to learn them call my eldest, who have a strong West Indian accent, them call him slow as a slow coach when him first arrive at the school. That's what them call him. Now this is a boy who could read and write and do some basic arithmetic when him 3 year old, because I make sure him could. If a teacher think a child stupid, him start to act stupid at a bare fact. I give up hope for him, my eldest, but I won't make it happen to me other two. Will give up my job if I have to. So tell me, what we can do for them?
Send them to one of our supplementary Saturday schools. That's the first thing you can do now. And they are free.
So that was your experience. You attended a Saturday school.
Yes, I attended Saturday schools. I attended the first one in Hammersmith, actually, the first Saturday school, even before I knew. And then another one later on in West London, yes. So that was education. It was like the current pulling me back into the sea a bit, because I didn't really want to confront that. That was very painful as well, the education, but I had to. All of this stuff, it's like the current. You know, you're lying on the beach, and that current is pulling you, dragging you into the sea, and there's slight resistance from yourself, but you cannot resist.
I know everybody is ready. Franklin, I see you.
Ready.
Nice and slow.
One of the most original films in the series is Lover's Rock. Lover's Rock is the story of a blues.
A blues party, which is what we create in this film, was a party where people would turn their front rooms into sort of discotheques. And this happened because black people were not really invited into clubs in the UK. So they would roll up the carpet in the front room, put the couch and everything into the back room and make it into a discotheque.
The living room is empty of furniture and full of dancers. Young men and young women are gathering together, dancing separately, dancing together, as a DJ paces the crowd with his choice of music. Lover's Rock is simply one of the great modern musicals. It's a graceful romantic drama that also brings to light underlying social crises in the community, a story of money and of gender-based violence. Ultimately, it's a work of expansive, rapturous lyricism, and it's derived in large part from the experiences of Steve McQueen's aunt.
My aunt, sort of nocturnal adventures in London. My grandmother was quite strict, and she wouldn't allow her to sort of go to these sort of all-night parties, but my uncle used to leave the back door open for her to go. Again, it's very West Indian, you know, in that sense, the way of, you know, party on Saturday, church on Sunday. And that's what happened to her. So, you know, yeah, it was like it's a Cinderella story, really.
One of the things that struck me about the three of the films that I saw is their stylistic diversity. The subject of the story, subjects are very different, and the way you film them is very, very different. So, for instance, Lover's Rock, it's a virtual musical.
Yes. That's what I was after. I really wanted to make a musical for a long time, but it's like, how do you find it? And I think we found it. We found it in a way because that place was a place where people could be themselves for a night. I mean, it's like any working class person. I mean, a lot of the West Indian young people, 9 to 5 going to jobs, unfortunately, you know, facing a sort of racial situation at jobs and the unrest and the being targeted a lot by police. There was a lot of tension with the West Indian community, especially the second generation, because they weren't like their parents. They weren't meek. They fought back. And this place became this refuge. Those young people, it was their space. It wasn't a space their parents gave them. It wasn't a space that anything else. It was a space that they invented. Perfumed the air with the music of the time, which was Lover's Rock.
I have to call attention to that moment in this, like at the very center of Lover's Rock, when the DJ stops the music and the entire crowd of dancers continues to sing Silly Games a cappella. It lifted me out of my seat. It's an exquisite moment.
Well, you hope for those moments. You could encourage it, but you can't push it. So therefore, what happened was just people were just so comfortable, and it just went on and on and on.
So that scene was not strictly choreographed or programmed.
No, it couldn't have been because I knew that there were. I turned it off. Of course, hopefully they would sing. But then you got to go with it because it's in the air. People were so comfortable with each other. Again, I think it was like being in the blues. People saw each other. You know, in England, unfortunately, Britain, we often, you know, black actors never have the opportunity to play themselves. So they can't really add to the role. It's almost like they stick to the script. And in this environment, they could be totally and utterly themselves. Of course, these are great actors because they're limited by the period. And language and so forth, but they're so great that they could operate within those limitations. And how I like to work often, I write the harmony and melody, but you can improvise within the harmony and the melody. You can do what you want as long as it stays within the harmony and the melody. And that's what happened. It's about making possibilities. That's what it's about.
The films in Small Axe aren't just personal for McQueen. They're also personal for his cast. John Boyega stars in Red, White, and Blue. It's based on the true story of Leroy Logan, a young black man in London who joins the police force with the explicit intention of reforming it. His desire to do so is sparked by his relationship with his father, a truck driver who was brutally beaten and wrongly arrested by white London officers.
Isn't that what you taught us? Isn't that what you drilled into us? Study every hour, God said. Don't leave the house or mix with the black kids. Educate ourselves at the expense of our lives. You made us feel like we could be a part of everything. You wanted us more British than the British. At least this way, Dad, I can change things. Dad, seriously, what do you think I am?
I really don't know.
Wow.
I couldn't understand. The only way I could get into that story really was with the proof of the father and the son. That was the only way I got first deal with it. Because I think Leroy, I didn't really understand him at first, I'll be honest with you. Because at a certain point, I thought the father was more radical than the son. I really did. I thought, this is weird. The father's more radical than the son. And I think what was interesting for me, at the same time, of course, was John Boyega and what was going on with him. As we were shooting Red, White, and Blue, John was taking part in this march in Hyde Park about Black Lives Matter. to deal with, you know, unfortunately, the unfortunate killing of George Floyd. And he gave a speech, obviously, in Hyde Park, which was extremely powerful.
It's very vital. Black lives have always mattered. We have always been important. We have always meant something. We have always succeeded, regardless. And now is the time. I ain't waiting.
And I know for a fact, and he has said it, that making Red, White, and Blue influenced him at that time. So you have two poster boys in our movie. You have Leroy Logan, who was the poster boy for the Metropolitan Police. In fact, he was a poster boy to recruit other minority policemen. And you have John Boyega, the poster boy of Star Wars. There you have it, two people doing the trying to sort of work within the industry that they're passionate about, and still not being able to reach the heights that they could have. It's not answering your question at all, but it's just something I had to say in order to sort of understand how we got to the end of the picture, because all these things were going on at the same time when things were being unearthed and discovered, excavated and discovered, and that's all.
When I watch a movie, one of the things that I hope to feel is the sense that the filmmaker is making images that he or she need to see personally. Not just that they want to show, but that they want to see for themselves. And I feel that with the films of Small Axe, that you were making films that you yourself needed to see, the images that matter to you personally.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you definitely had to see those images. And I had to see those images because I wanted to feel existence. No, I want to feel that I existed. You know, this exists. This is part of the narrative of the world, part of the narrative of life. And then sometimes things like that never get seen or never get noticed or never get the recognition or never get the light shone on them. And it's not about recognition. It's about the attention more than anything else. If we don't see certain images, then we sort of deny ourselves a certain kind of truth, or we try to hide it because we're not strong enough to sort of deal with it, or we don't want to see things because, you know, we don't want to think about it. But again, it's a classic thing. If you don't know your past, you don't know your future. I had to go there. I had to get in there to understand it, to unravel it. It's, you're looking for the truth, and often, possibly, you can find it.
Director Steve McQueen. His series Small Axe is showing on Amazon right now. And he spoke with Richard Brody, and you can read Richard on the movies all the time at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with Larissa McFarker, a longtime staff writer for the magazine. Larissa, you worked a long time on a story about the difficulties of leaving an extremely tight-knit religious community, specifically when a person wants to leave the community and divorce their spouse. What led you to want to look into this?
Well, the religious community you're referring to is what's often called the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, though they call themselves Haredi, which is H-A-R-E-D-I. And so what drew me to it is the impossibility of the situation where you have one parent who is more or less secular and another parent who is still a member of an ultra-Orthodox or Haredi community. And a court somehow has to figure out how their children are going to be raised. And I wanted to look into it because I just could not imagine how to figure this out when the norms and the beliefs of these two ways of life are really irreconcilable.
You spoke to three different people for this piece in depth. Tell me about them.
So I spoke to a couple of lawyers who deal with these custody cases between one secular parent and one religious parent. But first I spoke to Hani Getter. And she grew up in Rockland County, which is about 25 miles northwest of New York City. And her family is very religious. She was not one of these kids who rebelled at an early age. She loved her religion. She loved her family, and she loved her whole world.
I grew up with so much joy, so much singing. We were a pious group of people, putting God before anything else. God was an intimate friend and was someone you connected with really deeply. And that's a beautiful thing, to have that kind of connection and that kind of joy, that kind of grounding where the world is so difficult, but you have this beautiful love that surrounds you all the time.
When you were married in an arranged marriage when you were 18. Did you expect to be happy as a married woman?
I didn't grow up with fairy tales. I didn't expect it to be happily ever after. I expected to be able to build a beautiful home with someone else. As in all communities, we have unwritten rules about what happens. And the unwritten promise in the community is that you'll get married and you'll build a life and you'll have peace, and both of you will work towards creating a beautiful home for God and find a way to work together and be together, and happiness will come from that.
And that didn't happen.
Not for me.
In the community Honey grew up in, modesty is very important. And one of the traditions is the morning after a woman's wedding, her mother comes and shaves off her hair.
I know it sounds so vain in some way, but I had had long hair my entire life. I have very thick hair, and it means something. And the night before, I think both of us, my ex and I, had a traumatic experience in terms of what happened with the sex. I can't speak for him, but I would venture to guess that it was not pleasant. Neither of us really knew what we were doing. And the next morning, after the most intimate act you can do with another person, especially someone you don't know, and it's terrifying, my mother showed up with clippers and shaved my head off, and I felt like my entire identity was gone. And as I'm telling you the story, I'm thinking about an ex-sister-in-law of mine who tells the same story, and how she loved that her mother came and shaved her hair. And then she started wearing a wig because she hated her uncontrollable hair, right? So as I tell you my trauma, the same thing happens to another person and they're grateful and excited. It's not a one-way thing, these rituals and the way that they impact us.
And when did you find out or begin to get language for the idea that you were gay?
That's a wonderful question. Like, when did I start having language about being gay? After I had my second child, I was having physical
issues. Honey told me a story that during her second pregnancy, she was essentially put on bed rest, and her husband bought a television, which was not really allowed in their community. This was around the time that Ellen DeGeneres had come out. When Hani's husband came home, she talked to him about it.
I said to him, you know, I think I'm a lesbian. And he said, what's that? And I explained that it's a woman who's attracted to women. And he said, yeah, of course you are. And we continued on our day as if nothing happened and we had another child.
Now, why was this not a bigger deal in your marriage?
Because we didn't know it could be. Just because I was attracted to people that didn't mean that I could live a life like that. I hadn't figured that piece out. And there's something about growing up in a religious community where there are no love stories, where you don't see physical contact between men and women, that made it totally okay in my mind for me to be gay, because I really believed that women were attracted to women and got married to men to have children. I didn't know any other way. Nobody spoke about attraction, and so it never occurred to me that men were actually attracted to women or vice versa. For me, living in a community and lying about who I was not going to work. There are so many people that I know who are gay or lesbian within the community and have their Dallases outside and then stay because it's so complicated to leave. But for some of us, living authentic is more important than belonging in a community.
Chani Gedder was 23 years old and the mother by then already of three kids when she decided that her life had to change. What happened within her and what was the process of trying to leave like?
Well, it actually took her a few years before she left the community. The first thing she did was leave her marriage and go into therapy. And this is the other thing. Chani got divorced around 20 years ago, and that's part of why she's able to talk to us, because her kids are grown. Whereas people who are in the middle of custody cases now, they can get incredibly contentious and traumatic. I spoke to a lawyer who's negotiated more than 700 of these cases.
Yeah, I have my iPhone recording.
His name is Joel Yacoub.
I definitely find that religious divorces are more emotionally involved because when you're contacted by a client, you're never contacted by a person by themselves. You're going to have their rabbi involved. You're going to have brothers-in-law, their father, and you feel that pressure because the whole community wants to know what's happening in the case. But when you're successful, you get that reward as well.
Joel Yacoub more often represents the religious partner. He spoke to me from his office. So what are some of the differences between a divorce in an ultra-Orthodox community and a secular divorce?
The level of detail that you have to address in a religious divorce versus a secular divorce. Everything from the style of headdress that a man or boy wears upon reaching bar mitzvah, to the length of his payas, to how far a girl's skirt would be. Does she wear stockings? Are they clear stockings, not clear stockings? To the curriculum in a school. Plus you have the fact that there's a Jewish holiday every month of the year except for 1 month. And so you have an agreement that can be so much more complex than a regular secular divorce.
It's interesting. I've seen that a lot of the time courts may side with the religious parent, even though the courts are secular, because they value stability in the children's lives. Why do you think they side so often with the religious parent?
It's an easier sell to a judge to say, look, child's 2 years old. I'm going this way. She's going that way. We need to find a middle ground where we can be both be in that child's life, right? I think that's an easier case. But once you get to, you know, I've got four kids. They're all over the age of eight now, you know, and they're semi-teenagers. And their entire life being and peer group is in this community. Judges recognize divorce is so destabilizing for children. And the last thing that they're going to do is kind of allow one parent to just jolt that even more.
One of the things I'm wondering about is how it seems like the courts do sometimes seem to value stability so much in the child's life that they value it more than the relationship with the second parent, the second parent being the one who's moved away from the community to become more secular, the one who threatens the stability of their life as it's been to that point. Does that seem right to you?
I put the onus on the parent. That's really the way I view it. It's not about the parent at all. It's about the kid. So if you feel, I'm giving an example, that it's so important to take a child to a gay pride parade because of the way it makes you feel and how you perceive it's going to affect, you know, maybe the way this child's going to have a worldview. I think in certain cases, that's a reckless act. And I think in certain cases, that's a beautiful act. It really depends on the circumstances.
So you can see how much is at stake in this argument. If you're an LGBTQ parent or a secular parent, Joel is saying that your values might be distressing and confusing to your child because they conflict so totally with the religious values the child has been raised with and which his other parents still believes in.
To me, it's not about like an issue of expression, that this parent is no longer allowed to express themselves the way that they want. I think a parent, you know, when I have children, there's so many things we give up, you know, including our sleep to, you know, our time. It's one of the sacrifices you make. And they're in an unfortunate position, but I think you just have to give some care in thinking about not what would make you most happy, but what would kind of work for the child.
Losing sleep is one thing for your kids, and we all do that. But I think losing your constitutional rights is a bridge too far, and it's one that the courts won't make you do.
That's Julie Kay. She is a legal strategist for Footsteps, which is an organization that helps people who are leaving or pulling away from Hasidic communities.
I've had, you know, attorneys for the children and others say to me, well, you know, this would all go away if your client would just go back in the closet. A wise psychiatrist who specializes in contested divorces once told me, you know, children are made of rubber, not glass, and that it's important for them to be able to learn to navigate these spaces with loving and cooperating parents on both sides. And I think, you know, what I would say is that the ultra-Orthodox community has to start to embrace these families more.
Larissa, so what do you make of all this? It sounds like both lawyers pretty much agree that everyone should be looking out for the children. So what's the issue here?
Well, the issue is that they're, of course, very different ideas about what's good for the children, right? And the question is, how do they reconcile these really irreconcilable worlds? And honestly, I think that both sides underestimate how hard it is to do. So Joel believes that Footsteps does really great work in providing its members with emotional support. But now that it's also hiring lawyers to litigate these custody cases, he thinks they're creating more problems.
I think when they have gone and really petitioned so many, you know, large law firms to do pro bono work, it's with the pitch that this is about, you know, freedoms, rights for transgendered, rights for gay rights. And I think that's where I kind of think that they're off in their approach, because it's about the children. It's not about individual rights. If you were seeing courts not respect the rights of parents who are gay or transgendered, absolutely bring in the big law firms and let's establish the right, you know, of them as parents. But we have those rights, and those rights are never trampled on.
This is true. The courts have not technically denied custody to an LGBTQ parent or a secular parent. But the question is what those parents can do around their children and how they raise them. Whether or not the secular parent has to pretend to go along with religious rules that they no longer believe in. A few years ago, the norm was to ask the secular parent to basically just fake it, to pretend while they're with their kids that they're still religious. But there was a big case in 2017, the Weisberger case, that changed that standard. In Weisberger, basically, the court said that the secular parent did not have to lie about who she was. But it did require her to make sure that her children continued to follow religious rules. So what Julie wants to establish in the future is that forcing secular parents to monitor their kids' religious observance is really not all that different from forcing them to be observant themselves.
It turns the parent into a religious nanny or a religious cop, that he now has to make sure that his children are following religious norms that he himself doesn't have a deep-seated belief in. I think that really starts to interfere with having an authentic parenting relationship.
You might think that the way to solve these problems would be just for the two parents to tolerate each other's worldviews and that the kids should just go back and forth. But if you belong to a religious minority, you might see it very differently. Here's the way Joel sees it.
I think you have to realize that the religious parent is probably more on the defense than the offense, because everything that a more secular parent wants to expose their child to is generally something enjoyable. It's not like the secular parent saying, you're going to sit and do 10 hours of, you know, secular studies and learn American history. It's you're going to get to watch YouTube, get to use an iPhone, go and play in, you know, a secular swimming pool with mixed gender. And most of their community is built around shielding themselves from those things so that they don't succumb to the desire.
You know, I'm not sure I completely agree with Joel here. I mean, I understand that it can seem like iPhones and YouTube are irresistible, and I'm sure to some kids they are. And of course, many people have left religious communities of all kinds because of the lure of secular life. But in fact, the pull on the religious side is also very, very strong. It's everyone and everything the child has ever known. It's their whole world. So this is really the tragedy of divorces of this kind, where one parent is secular and one is religious. It's not like with a secular divorce where the parents might have slightly different rules or badmouth each other. It's a situation where you're going from one parent who says something is fun and normal to another parent who says it's a violation of the laws of God. And even if a court grants both parents partial custody, it's just very hard to imagine how a child makes sense of that without ultimately rejecting one parent or the other.
You can read Larissa McFarker's piece about the organization Footsteps at NewYorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. Thanks for listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. We'll see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Lea, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Danny Bonner, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.